Hello, I'm testing, testing here. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. By just identifying yourself and saying who it is, you know, the date and
All right.
who you are and
Okay,
so on.
this is Sunday, March 13th, 1983. This is Tom Cascione from Vancouver speaking. I was a former flying officer in the Royal Canadian Air Force, attached to 138 Squadron at Tempsford in the RAF. Very young guy. I joined up when I was 18, much to my parents' dismay. I had a few things to prove, and I wanted to fly very much so, and I was a very loyal Canadian. So I thought the best way to do this was to join the Air Force and fight Germans. Let's try it.
Okay.
All right, this is Tom Cascione. I'm a Vancouver resident. I used to belong to the Royal Canadian Air Force. I was 18 when I joined up. I was from Kelowna, born in Alberta. I was intrigued with the idea of flying, and I was a very, very loyal Canadian, and I wanted to get into the battle. I would say, one of the most naive people you've ever met in your life. I didn't know anything about flying. I couldn't drive a car. I knew nothing about machinery, but I was determined to fly, and as I say, I wanted to prove a few things. I wanted to prove that I was a good fighter and a good man. So I joined the Air Force and in Canada, trained initially as a pilot, and I soloed in a Tiger Moth when I was about, oh, 18 and a half years old. I soloed at 7.5 hours, and then from there I went to another station where I was transferred to Anson Aircraft, where I learned to fly them. I got in a little trouble there. I had a girlfriend in Ontario, and I decided to shoot up the town with an Anson aircraft, which was not allowed. So I dove on this town, and the girl saw me, but unfortunately some other members of the Air Force saw me. So I was kicked off the pilot's course and offered a job in some other form of aircrew. So I decided to take up what was called the bomb aimer's job. Bomb aimers, as the name implies, drops the bombs and does some map reading and is a co-pilot on most bomber crews. So I graduated from there and was shipped overseas. I was barely 19.
Can you tell me what year this would be?
About the latter part of 1941. And arrived in Bournemouth. Again, we were all in the same boat. Nearly all the fellows were in the same age group. I was one of the younger ones, but we were very close. And we arrived, and we were put up at some of the most fantastic hotels in Bournemouth you've ever seen. And to illustrate how naive we were, one of the things we didn't know about, we went in this hotel, there was a bidet. We all thought it was for washing your feet because it was shaped like a foot. So after Bournemouth, we were shipped to different stations, and we went to an operational training unit on Wellington bombers, twin-engine Wellington bombers. And one of the exercises there was to simulate a bombing raid on London at night. There were three targets, and we were supposed to bomb them with a camera. And there were about 12 aircraft on this. So luckily, or by what, and I don't know, I had very good night vision. But anyway, I hit all three targets with a camera, and I got direct hits on all three targets. So when we got back, we were interviewed by the intelligence officer, and he asked if we would like to go on special duties. And we didn't know what special duties was, and he wasn't about to tell us. All he would say was that it's different from bomber command and that it would be more interesting work. So we got together and we discussed it, and I think I was instrumental in talking the other fellows into it. I said, I don't think we're going to come through this anyhow, so we may as well have a little bit of fun and do something interesting.
Why did you say you didn't think you were going to come through it anyway?
Well, we were hit with this psychology from the moment we hit Bournemouth. The RAF and the RCAF hit us with this fact that very few aircrew ever survived, and there was no reason to be frightened, but to go ahead and do your job because you weren't going to make it anyhow.
And you shouldn't be frightened?
You shouldn't be frightened, which, you know, for a young kid is pretty good psychology. You tend to relax. You say, okay, if this is the score, you believe everything they tell you, you go ahead and do it. The older guys didn't believe it. But we were 18, 19, 20 years old, so we swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, and I believed it. So I thought, oh, hell with it, I'm going to have a good time.
Can I just take you, I don't want to interrupt the chronology, but there was one thing that did want to ask you. At the beginning, you said something about I really had a lot of things to prove.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember when we first talked, you told me that you wanted to prove that you were a better Canadian than others.
Right.
Can you say something about that, why that would be?
Well, with a name like mine, my name is Cascione, or actually in Italian, Cacchioni. I was of Italian origin. Both my parents had been born in Italy. And naturally, at this time, Italy was in the war against Britain. And I was looked upon as a foreigner, even though I'd been born in Canada and raised in the Okanagan. And because of this, I had a real chip on my shoulder. And I felt that I wasn't a foreigner, I was a true Canadian, and that I was going to show these SOBs that I was a better Canadian than they were. So I set out to prove it, and I think in the long run I did. And unfortunately, our children don't have the same incentive today. But this, for me, was a great incentive.
Did you find any kind of hostile or discriminatory attitudes in the forces?
Yes, very much so. I was interviewed at the initial training school by a Flight Lieutenant Dalrymple. I still remember him. He was a jerk. And he called me in for my interview for being graduating as an officer. And he said, "Now, Cascione, that's an Italian name." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Of course you like Mussolini." And I said, "No, I don't like Mussolini. I don't even know Mussolini. I couldn't even pronounce it." He called him Mussolini, which is a ridiculous name. The name is Mussolini, I found out later. But he went on and on, and I said, "Look," I said, "I don't like him. As a matter of fact, my father's a communist. He hates Mussolini." Well, that settled it. Then he figured I was officer material. It was dumb, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But I had no politics in me at all.
Right.
It was strictly, just a thing I had to prove, and I did love Canada very, very much. I still do. I still do. I love this country very much.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to, you know,
oh, no, that's
I
good.
Don't want to drag you out of your story, but
no,
I...
No, that's good. So anyhow, so we volunteered for this mission, and my pilot at the time was a warrant officer. I won't mention his name. So we get to, we went to conversion unit at Croft in Northern England, where we converted from twin-engine bombers to four-engine Halifax bombers. And so after Croft, we converted, and we arrived in Thamesford, the Special Duty Squadron. And we were interviewed by the intelligence officer there, who told us that this was a very secretive squadron, and anything that we did or heard was not to be mentioned, that if we did mention it in any of the local pubs or outside of the squadron, that we would disappear, and it was very hush-hush, as they called it. And the squadron I was assigned to was 138 Squadron. On the same squadron was another one called 161, on the same station, 161 Squadron, that did a different job. So when you first arrive on a squadron, a fresh squadron, a fresh crew, the navigator, the pilot, and the bomb aimer are sent out on second dickey trips. I think I mentioned this to you last time. Second dickey trip means that you fly with a seasoned crew on two or three trips to let you know what to do. So off we went with separate crews, and our pilot, the warrant officer, permanent RAF fellow, who was a very nice fellow but not very macho, he was shot down. And all the crew escaped except my pilot. He was shot down over Denmark. He's still there, I think, but he never came back. So we were assigned to another pilot, again, a permanent RAF fellow, a flight lieutenant. Again, I won't mention any names. But the second fellow, who would like to turn back. If we get halfway across the channel, he'd say, "Uh-oh, the oil pressure's dropping. Uh-oh, the temperature on the port engine is rising." And he had every damn reason in the world for turning back. So after we'd been abused this way for about five trips, I got aside. I talked to him aside, and I said, "Look, Johnny," I said, "we're never going to finish this thing." And he was a little annoyed with me because I was an inferior rank. I was a pilot officer. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You're turning back too damned often." And I said, "I'm never going to finish this tour." So we had a good talk, and from then on, it wasn't only me. The intelligence officer and the group captain talked to him as well. He got a little bit more brave, and he finished his tour. But then we were switched to another pilot, this time a Canadian named Hiram Walker, who was a very different bird. He had more guts than you could ever imagine. So we started our tour, and very interesting work. I was very glad that I didn't go to Bomber Command. I enjoyed this work. It consisted mainly of dropping supplies to the underground, to the resistance in Europe, all over Europe and Norway, and dropping saboteurs who we call Joes. These were trained agents to do sabotage work in Europe. And I've made a few notes here that'll just help me clarify it. I should mention one thing before I carry on further. I was with a fellow named Matt Carter, who also lives in Vancouver, and this operational training unit. And we went to London one night, and we were on leave. It was actually three nights, and we ran out of money. And we were in this nice pub, this nice hotel. So Matt Carter says, I said, well, he said, we need some money. He said, I see a fellow over there with a monocle. He said, I'll go and ask him to cash a check. Did I tell you about this?
No, you didn't.
Yeah. So I said, Mac, I said, he doesn't even know us. He said, that doesn't matter. And Mac had a thick skin. He still has. And so he goes over, and we were with two lovely ladies. And he brings this fellow over, and the fellow introduces himself. He's a Belgian. I still remember his name, De Kock Brunier. I don't know how to spell it, but his name was De Kock Brunier. And he kisses the ladies' hands, and they thought he was fantastic. And so he says to her, how much money do you want? And we said, well, we'd like about £50. He says, no problem. So he writes out a check to the RAF Benevolent Fund for £50 and gives us £50. Write it out to us, but then he puts on an RAF Benevolent Fund. So we thought, what a wonderful man. So we invited him to spend the rest of the evening with us, which he did. And he started telling us how he hated the Germans and how he'd escaped from Belgium with his wine cellar and how lucky he was and all the rest of it. We thought he was fantastic. And he thought we knew something. So he kept name dropping. Do you know group captain so-and-so? Do you know wing commander so-and-so? We didn't know any of these guys. We didn't know anything. Carter was just as dumb as I was. So next day he said, be sure and look me up at the Belgian Club. We couldn't even remember where the heck it was next morning. So he invited us up to his farm in Surrey when we were on leave next time. All the eggs we want, all the bacon. He invited the ladies up as well. So we finished our leave, and we thought, what a nice man. And we get back to the station. There's the Scotland Yard waiting for us and the District Air Provost Marshal waiting for us. And I looked at Carter, and I said, Mac, what did we do? He said, I don't know. So they call Carter in first. And he's in there for an hour. And he comes out, and he says, boy, where did you get in there? So I was in next, and they wanted to know exactly what we told him and everything else. And I said, well, couldn't tell him much because we don't know much. He turned out he was a German spy, and they knew it. And they'd been watching him and watching all his contacts. And they wanted to know what he'd asked us, who he'd asked about, and all the rest of it. We knew boom all, so they just laughed and let us go. Interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. De Kock Brunier, I'll never forget him. But anyhow, we arrived at Thamesford, and this was about 1942. Thamesford was the main center from which Special Air Service and Special Operations Executive were supplying resistance movements with arms, agents, and equipment during the war. The two names I've given, Special Air Service, were abbreviated by, if you read any literature on this, SAS, you know this, David, and the other one is SOE, Special Operations Executive. They were the cloak and dagger boys, and boy, they were tough. So 138 Squadron, the one I was on, we used Halifax bombers, Stirling bombers, and occasionally Lancasters, which were borrowed from another squadron, to carry equipment and to drop agents. 161 Squadron used Lysanders and Hudsons to actually land in enemy-occupied territory and to pick up downed aircrew and agents. These pilots were automatically awarded the DFC after successfully completing five trips. Did you know that? Five trips, they got the Distinguished Flying Cross, and they earned every bit of it. The underground people who assisted them always rewarded them with their very best perfume and cognac. One of my friends, George Ash, was on this. He was a gunner on the Lysander. And he came up to me one night and he whispered, he says, Tom, he said, I'm going over to land in France tomorrow night. He said, they tell me I can get some cognac. He said, I've never had it. He said, have you ever had it? I said, no. Did I tell you this story?
You didn't tell me about getting drunk on cognac.
Oh, God, did we ever. He came back with his cognac, and we went to the local dance, and we started to drink it like wine. Well, the first thing I knew, George was on the floor underneath the table, and I could hardly see. We had bikes at the time. We used to drive our bikes into Thamesford, into the pub. So I fell off my bike, and I left George there. I couldn't pick him up. And I lit a bush with a flame, trying to find my way back to the squadron. And the MPs picked me up and said, where are you going, sir? And I said, I'm trying to find the airport. So they led me back with a chuckle, and next morning they went and got George, but we clunked right out. I mean, this cognac is fantastically powerful stuff. I still don't drink it. It's too tough for me. So he didn't make it. George got killed on one of his trips.
Did you mix much with people from 160?
No, very seldom. He was the only one I did.
Mm-hmm. Mix. Why was that? Was that a question of choice, or were you under orders?
I think it was intimated that we shouldn't. because they didn't want too many people knowing what they were doing, and they didn't want them knowing what we were doing. And but George and I became pretty good friends in the mess, and so that was it. But George did about 7 trips, and then one.
Was he a Canadian?
Yes, he was Canadian from back east somewhere. Hell of a nice guy. Some of the material we dropped by canisters are quite interesting. We dropped explosives, detonators, machine guns, usually Sten guns, ammunition, carrier pigeons, counterfeit money. One night we dropped a fortune in counterfeit money near Switzerland, and we all wanted to jump out with it, but we were too loyal to do that, of course. Chemicals to ruin enemy vehicle engines, timing devices, radios, printing presses, and agents that we call Joes. And it was quite very interesting work. When I arrived at Tensford, a tour consisted of 30 trips. This was lengthened to 250 hours shortly after I arrived. Isn't that lucky? And I figured for sure my time was up, but being a good Catholic, I knew where I was going. I ended up doing 41 trips. Our flying was nearly always done on moonlight nights and at low level to avoid enemy radar and night fighters. Most of our aircraft that failed to return were downed by light anti-aircraft fire and by misfortune in hitting hills and other land hazards. My particular specialty was as a map reader. I was graduated as a bomb aimer, but at Tempsford we did no bomb dropping. I had very good eyes for night vision, and by the time we had done 15 trips, I knew northern France, Holland, and Belgium very well. The Loire River in France always seemed like a fluorescent winding band at night. We would map read to our designated area, search out the flashlights on the ground, wait for the proper light signal, turn into the wind, drop to about 600 or 700 feet, open our bomb bay doors, sometimes drop our undercarriage to slow us down even more, and I would press the canister release button. If we were carrying a Joe agent, our dispatcher would assist him, and out he would go on a static line. One night we were carrying 2 of these volunteer Joes on their first trip. We opened the large circular dropping hatch. These 2 brave souls had a change of heart and didn't want to jump. Our orders were to try coaxing and even giving them rum. And if that didn't work, we were to push them out. We did the latter to both of these fellows. I don't know what happened to them, but out they went. Our longest trip was to Norway to drop a female agent and her canisters and her radio equipment. We found out later that her mission was to keep us informed of the movements of the Tirpitz battleship, which was holed up in a fjord in Norway. Nearly all of the agents we dropped were great patriots and unbelievably brave. They usually worked in teams of 4 or 5 and were constantly being searched out by the SS and the Gestapo. Once caught, they were treated as spies, tortured, and killed. The average lifespan of an agent dropped into occupied Europe was 6 months. During one period, the Germans captured one of our first Dutch agents that we had dropped into northern Holland. They tortured him and made him play back as if he hadn't been captured. All of our agents had been trained to signal in their transmission a certain series to indicate that they were sending under enemy supervision. The British failed to recognize the code in this case, and we continued to drop nearly 50 more agents right into the Germans' hands. After the war, General Galen, the head of the German counterintelligence in Holland, wrote a book on this catastrophe. It was called Operation Nordpol, Nordpole. All but one of the agents were tortured and killed. Holland was furious. I was not quite 20 years old when I arrived at Tensford. Being of Italian origin and with a very Italian name, I was viewed very suspiciously at first. However, once I had completed 15 or so trips, everyone realized that I wasn't an Italian spy. I was fully accepted. One night after a few drinks in the officer's mess, Major Tice, our intelligence officer, came over to me. He asked if I could speak Italian. I answered no, but that I could understand it. He wanted to train me in sabotage, etc., and have me lead a group into northern Italy. I thanked him very much and said I was quite happy in what I was doing. And at this time, I didn't know that the average lifespan was 6 months. But since then, I've read on this material. I'm damn glad I thanked him and said no. I wouldn't have been good at that work. I'm not the type of person that could sneak up behind a guard and slit his throat cold-bloodedly. I'm not that sort of person. One event that always stuck in my mind was the one concerning the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. I don't know if I mentioned this to you, did I?
I don't think so.
When these poor people openly came out against the Germans, they radioed London for arms and ammunition. The Russians, our ally at the time, so-called ally, were only about 100 miles on the other side of them, but refused to help. London knew it was a futile gesture. that asked Temsford to send three volunteer aircraft to try and make a successful drop into the ghetto. Fantastic distance, all over enemy occupied territory. Our pilots drew straws, and the three unlucky crews took off knowing that their chance of survival was almost nil. None of them came back. That's
were
sad.
You there then?
Yeah, I was there. And I saw this. I saw these guys volunteering and walking out and knowing that they were dead. And if I'd been one of them, I would have gone too. Now, that may be stupid. I don't know. But this is the discipline that was instilled in us. And it's fantastic, isn't it? We walk right into death, and you do it. I guess it's dumb, but I don't know. I felt sorry for these poor Jewish people in Warsaw. And you always feel you'll never get killed, and that's how I, towards the end, I felt I was indestructible. Now I don't. My last trip was supposed to be a real nice favor. I'd done 39 trips, and I knew that 41 would be finished. So they said, how would you like to fly over southern France and drop a bunch of junk into the southern France, not junk, arms and ammunition, and then carry on to Africa and get some nice sunshine, swim in the Mediterranean, and all the rest of it. Pick up another load and come back. And I said, oh, that's nice. So we started out, and we had engine trouble on both motors on the starboard side. And we managed to find our target in the Lyon area. We dropped it, and we carried it out over Lyon, but we got lost, hopelessly lost. It fogged in. And so prior to takeoff, I'd memorized the whole southern coast of France for flak spots. And I still remember there was one spot that didn't have any red on it. Red was flak. And southern France, it was called Point A-G-D-E, Agde. I don't know how you pronounce it in French.
Agde.
Well, anyhow, that was the one. I want to see that if I ever go to France. And because we broke broad daylight over Marseille, one lone Halifax bomber, and this was occupied by Germans. And they must have thought we were a German bomber because they didn't send up any flak or any fighter. They could have shot us out of the sky. So I said to my pilot, I said, hi, it's hard starboard and head for that point. So we headed for the point, and the Mediterranean looked so beautiful to us, nice and blue, and we carried right on, and we landed in Blida, North Africa near Algiers. And so our engineer was supposed to get the engines fixed. We were there for about a week, and we had a very good time. They treated us royally. So we picked up another load to do the same thing on the way back. Unfortunately, somebody goofed, either our engineer or the ground crew at Blida, and we got out about the middle of the Mediterranean, and all of a sudden, both starboard engines started coughing in the middle of the night. So then we knew we couldn't stay up. They stopped, and we couldn't stay up. We had inside gasoline tanks, which were very heavy. We were very heavily loaded. And so we debated then as to whether to ditch in the Mediterranean or crash land on the islands of Mallorca and Menorca, which were Spanish islands. And I'd heard so many horrible stories about what the Spaniards did to Canadians. There were only two Canadians in our crew. It was Hiram Walker and myself.
Hiram Walker was the pilot.
Yeah. And so I said, Hiram, and I said, I don't want to get handcuffed by Franco and his boys. They were very cruel. I said, if you're game, I'm game to ditch. He said, I am too. So we looked around, and we saw some lights in the water, and there was a ship lit up with a big red cross on it. It was an Italian Red Cross ship. But we didn't know it was Italian at the time. All we knew that it was a Red Cross ship. They were the only ones lighted up at night. So we ditched near him, and we made every mistake in the book. The inside tanks broke on us. The navigator panicked and was running back and forth while we were proceeding to ditch. And the wireless operator didn't get the radio out. I couldn't get the escape hatch open for the pilot. And how we got out of it, I don't know. And I was the only one that could swim. Isn't that nice, being raised in the Okanagan? Thank God for that. So finally, we got the escape hatch open for the pilot, and we ditched near the ship, and he could smell us a mile away, he told us later, because of the inside gasoline tanks, 100-octane gasoline. Oh, boy, it smelled horribly. My best friend was the navigator, and I knew that he'd panicked and hadn't gotten out, and so I kept going down for him, but I knew that the fumes were deadly, so I had left my parachute harness on, which you're not supposed to do when you ditch. So I took one end of it, and I gave it to some guy up above me. I still can't remember who it was. And I said, you hang on to this, and if I collapse, you pull me out. And I collapsed twice. And twice I had his hand, but then I collapsed. And I couldn't get him out. So finally, we got out in the aircraft. It's sinking. And we'd all been trained as to where the dinghy was and how to get it out. But the fumes had befuddled us. So finally, I realized where the damn dinghy release handle was, but you had to go back into the aircraft to get it. It's a red handle. So I finally reached, pulled the red handle, climbed out, and it was just stored in the wing. And the wing automatically burst open, and the dinghy inflated itself and went sailing merrily away, attached by a static line. Did I tell you about this? And the static line is stressed, so it'll break. It won't be pulled under by the aircraft. But none of us knew that anymore. We were so befuddled. So in I dove like a big hero, and I swam to the dinghy, grabbed the static line in my teeth, and I swim back, bring it to the aircraft, and everyone gets in. And then we get in the dinghy, and the plane starts to pull the static line. So Hiram Walker has a big pocket knife in his boot. He starts immediately to cut all the lines off the dinghy. That was all our supplies. Thank God the Red Cross ship was nearby. So the aircraft went down. It was a sad sight. It was our only aircraft. It was a fantastic aircraft.
You've been with that aircraft
yes,
all these
yeah.
Days.
You get very closely attached to them. And down it slipped into the water very gracefully. It was a real lady. And then the ship came along, the lifeboat came along, picked us up, and took us back. And it was an Italian Red Cross ship called the Principessa Giovanni, and but captured by the British under British command. But the captain and his crew were Italian. And they treated us beautifully. And they brought us in, and the captain was mad at his crew for being so slow in picking us up and put them on charge. And I thought they were beautiful. They did a good job. So they took us in, and they gave us brandy and everything else, and took us back to North Africa. And none of us wanted to fly for a while. Again, I was the youngest. So they finally said, well, fine, you're going to fly to Dakar in Western Africa, and then you're going to fly back to Britain. So after a nice day and, again, being treated very royally. Oh, first, they landed us at Oran, where the French fleet had been sunk by the British. Holy cow, most of our crew were RAF, British. And did the French hate them? They almost spat upon them. They liked us. As soon as they saw Canada on our shoulders, they fined Canada. But the RAF kids, they really treated dirty. They would have nothing to do with them. They wouldn't give them a drink in the pubs or anything. So they flew us from Dakar to, from Oran to Dakar. And then from Dakar, an RAF aircraft came and picked us up and flew us back to Britain.
Where in Britain did you go back to Thamesford?
Back to Thamesford. And this was my last trip. I'd finished my tour. What a way to finish it. So I was awarded 2 weeks completion of tour leave, which everyone got, and then 2 weeks survival leave.
What is survival leave?
For ditching and coming out of it. And we all got the goldfish thing. Have you ever seen the goldfish award for the people that make the dinghies?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's an official award. You can wear it in your uniform and everything. I've got it here somewhere. So okay?
Yeah, I'll just put it on the outside here so it doesn't get caught.
All right. So one of the job, Hiram Walker was posted back to Canada immediately. I don't know why. And I was the next senior guy in the crew, rank-wise. So he asked me to go up to see the navigator's wife and parents in Stafford. And I'd never done this before. I was a young kid, you see, and I'd never been involved in anything like this. So I said, all right, I would go. So I went up to Stafford. This was the first part of my leave. And I looked him up, and they had been told by the Air Ministry that there was a chance he was still alive. And there wasn't a chance. He was a dead duck. So it was my unpleasant duty to tell them that that he was gone. And there was his beautiful child and his wife, beautiful kid. The kid had just won a beauty contest. And then I told them this, and the tears were running down their eyes and down their faces. Oh, it was a horrible thing. They invited me for dinner, and I stayed. It was the most awful dinner I've ever had. I mean, you can't enjoy a dinner with people looking like that. Then they wanted to almost adopt me as a second son. And horrible thing to say, all I want to do is get out. It was tension, more tension to me. So I thanked them very much, and I went to the local pub. It was the first time I've ever gotten drunk by myself in my life. I sat in the pub, and I just kept drinking. And I didn't get successfully drunk. It was a very, very unfortunate thing to happen. But
he had been quite a close friend.
Oh, yes,
Your best friend on
yes,
the squadron?
Yes, yeah. Well, not on the aircraft.
My
best friend was another guy who was in Vancouver now, Jim Piercy, who was shot down after 6 trips, but a prisoner of war after that. But Tony and I were very close. See, in the RAF Halifax bomber, the navigator's right here, and the bomb dropper is right adjacent to him, about 10 inches away. So, and he was a very good man, but he should never have been flying. He used to get airsick all the time. But he didn't want to pack it in because in the RAF, they stamp your logbook, LMF. Did I tell you about that?
I think you did, but tell us.
Yeah, LMF stands for lack of moral fiber, which was ridiculous. This man just got airsick. He may have been tense or something. I don't know, but a lot of guys didn't. And if you didn't want to fly after all the training, they figured you were yellow and you had lack of moral fiber, and they stamped it on your logbook and put you on the ground. So he wouldn't go for that, which I think took a hell of a lot of courage. But they didn't. So, but anyhow, I left that, and so I got back to the squadron, and one of my very good friends there was a flying officer, Stevenson, an RAF fellow from southern Britain, and he'd finished his tour the same night I had. And so he came over to me, he said, you made it, Tom, and I said, yep, and I said, so did you, and we shook each other's hands very much. We became very close, you know. And a big treat in Britain, you know, was to get an egg during the war. After we did a trip, when you came back from a trip, an operational trip, they'd either give you a drink of rum or an egg. Not both, one or the other. And we always took an egg because they were so hard to get. So an egg became a thing of beauty, as Johnson would say. So he said, Tom, how would you like a dozen eggs? And I said, you're kidding. He said, no, I'm not. He said, my father's coming up to congratulate me on finishing the tour. And he said, I told him about you, and he's bringing up 2 dozen eggs. And I said, 2 dozen eggs? That was like heaven. So sure enough, his father came up, and I met him, and he congratulated Steve, his son, and myself. And we went to the mess, and we handed these 2 dozen eggs, dozen each, to the girl, the WAF, and we said, cook them up! And he ate a dozen, and I ate a dozen. We almost got sick, but we ate them, and everyone was clapping for us. It was quite a thing, quite a nice thing. The feeling was tremendous. Even to this day, I still, if I'm going into a business deal with someone, I look at them and I say, would I fly with that man? And if I say, my mind tells me, yes, you would fly with him, I go ahead with the deal. And it's never been wrong. Because in a bomber, you know, there were 7 of us, and each man was important. If one guy was weak, the whole damn thing went. And so they were very, very nice people. I really have a big soft spot in my heart for Britain and the British air crew. The Canadians, the British, and the Australians are all the same. They're fantastic people.
In your air crew, there were 2 Canadians. Were the rest British? Or?
Except one. Johnny Johnson was a Jamaican, and he was our wireless op. And that's quite a story, too. Johnny was quite a guy. He was a very intelligent man, very hyper man. One night we flew with a navigator that didn't know very much about what he was doing. He was a spare navigator. Our navigator had been sick. So I see Johnny coming, walking with his parachute in his hand towards the bomber, and he's got his Oxford strapped over his parachute. And I said, what's that for? He says, we're going for a Burton tonight. That means you're going to get killed. You're going for a Burton. And I said, what do you mean? He said, this navigator doesn't know what he's doing. He said, I've heard stories about him, and I had too, the whole squadron had. He was a very good-looking chap, handsome as heck and everything, nice personality, but he didn't know anything about navigating. So sure enough, he got us lost, hopelessly lost, and Johnny, the black Jamaican, was sure, his eyes were as big as saucers, he was sure we were going to get killed. So we get over France, we're hopelessly lost, and the pilot, Hiram Walker, says, pilot to navigator, he said, give me a course. And the navigator said, skipper, just a few minutes. This went on. He said, pilot navigator, give me a course. He said, I don't know where we are. And he said, I don't want to go through those clouds. And he said, just give me a few minutes. And about 10 minutes goes by. And by this time, Hiram Walker is getting a little annoyed. He said, for God's sakes, give me a course. And he says, pilot, navigator speaking, he said, climb to 10,000 feet and set course for Britain. This is unbelievable. The pilot said, what course? He says, I don't know. Can you believe that? This is suicide territory. So Walker said to me, Tom, what are you going to do? And I said, you know, we're not supposed to go through clouds unless we know what's down below. But I said, we've got to go through and see if I can pick up a pinpoint. As I say, I was a very good map reader. And I said, if you can just give me one quick look, I said, I think I can find out where we are. And so he said, all right, that's a horrible feeling, driving through cloud, because you can walk into a mountain so fast. And so we did, and finally the cloud broke, and sure enough, I picked up the Loire River, as I mentioned previously, and I knew exactly where we were, and we set course for Temsford and landed, and that was the last time that navigator ever flew, because that was dynamite. He shouldn't have been flying.
He was just sent off the
spot. He was sent away. I don't know what happened to him. He was just a nice guy, but he shouldn't have been flying. But anyway, I got to tell you about my leave. So after going to Stafford and seeing Tony's parents and his wife, a few of us went to London on leave. You can see this photograph here. That's an Australian. That's Johnny, the wireless op.
And that's
Jamaican. Yeah, and this is an Australian, and that's my son. And so we got to London, and we had a lot of money. So we really had a time in London. Oh, did we have a time. And this Jamaican fellow had married an English girl in the meantime, and a lovely girl, a white girl. And his father was a physician in Jamaica, Kingston. And when he got back to Jamaica, he was made sub-inspector of the Jamaican police force. Did I tell you about him?
I don't think so.
And she used to write to me, and then I didn't hear anything for about 6 months, and then I got a whole envelope of newspaper clippings. The idiot had gone to the police force station one day, and he'd come home quite drunk on rum, and his father had said to him, "What have you been doing?" He said, "We've been playing Russian roulette." And Johnny was no hero. He was not a brave man. And his father said, "What's that?" He says, "Well, you put one cylinder in a revolver, spin it, and put up your head and pull the trigger." And his father said, "I've never heard of such a thing." And Johnny said, "I'll show you." He did it and blew his brains out. And that's sad. He was a nice guy. That's the last I ever heard of his family. But anyway, we went on this leave, this 4 weeks leave. I took it for, I think, 2.5 weeks. By this time, I was flat broke. And I arrived back at Thamesford on the squadron. We had a railway pass to get back. And Flight Lieutenant Jaffe, our adjutant, said to me, "What are you doing back here?" And I said, "Jaffe, I'm broke." He said, I figured. So he said, "Well, stay here till you have to go away." So in the meantime, a whole new outfit had been organized to do the same work that we were doing at Thamesford in Burma. And it was the hottest pilot was a fellow named Squadron Leader Wilkinson, and a good navigator, I've forgotten who it was, and I was considered the best map reader and bomb dropper. And we were going to be on Hudson aircraft doing this in Burma. So as I said, I figured I was indestructible, so I volunteered for another tour in Burma. Nuts. So fortunately, Mackenzie King, our prime minister at the time, was holding an election in Canada, and he didn't want any more of our troops going away from Britain, or he wanted them back in Canada. Why he wanted men like me, I don't know. We hated his guts. We booed him, you know.
Why did you hate his guts?
He was a draft dodger in the First World War. He ran to the States. And none of us respected him at all. Absolutely, we thought he was a low, low man. I hate to say this, but we feel the same thing about our present prime minister, who was not in the service. He's my age as well. So anyhow, I volunteered for this, and there was a hot crew and everything, but they finally said, "No, that's enough," and they sent me up to a station up in northern Scotland to wait a ship to go back to Canada. And I was bored, a little bit bored, so I went out looking at the fields where they harvested the rye and material for Scotch whiskey. And they needed helpers to harvest the rye, so a whole group of us went out and helped them harvest the rye. We drank a little, too.
All in the service of humanity.
That's right. And then I got back to Canada, and I'd always wanted to be a dentist. I'd written to the University of Oregon Dental School when I was 16. But they sent me the brochure and the tuition, and I couldn't afford it. I came from a very poor family. So when I came back to Canada, I thought, well, heck, I'm going to try and see if I can get back on that field. And I nearly stayed in the Air Force. They offered me a permanent commission as an aerodrome control officer. You know, these fellows with flashes lights and stacks the aircraft up. But I decided that wasn't my life. I don't like military life. I don't like the BS that's concerned with it. So I got into UBC in the pre-dental school. And I did 2 years of pre-dental work in 11 months. And I was accepted at Oregon, and I went through Oregon with a bunch of my friends and graduated as a dentist, and that's what I'm doing now.
How old were you when you came back from Britain?
I wasn't.
Can you put a date to it?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how old I was. My birthday is December the 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. I arrived in Winnipeg, and I had a girlfriend in Winnipeg, and I wasn't quite 21. And I'd done 41 trips, I was a flying officer, and I'd been decorated. And I went into this liquor store to buy a bottle of whiskey. I think it was about December the 1st. And I was refused a bottle of whiskey because I wasn't old enough. I won't tell you what I said.
And what happened? Did you get out of that unscathed?
Well, a group of people came up and offered me their permit and everything, and I told them all to go to hell. I was so annoyed. I thought, this is ridiculous. If a man's old enough to fight, he's old enough to have a bottle of booze if he wants it. And I never abused liquor.
This would be 43.
Yes, about 43. That's right. Yeah, well, latter part of 43 and into 44. Mm-hmm. And then I remember I was out at UBC when there was I flew on D-Day. That was interesting. We dropped dummy paratroopers with explosive attached to them, away from where the action was so that the enemy would send their tanks after these dummy paratroopers and our boys wouldn't be nailed as badly as they normally would have been.
You were, just say that again?
D-Day.
You were in Europe?
We dropped these things on D-Day, the night of D-Day.
So that's 44. So
44, that's when I was there in 44 then. My dates are not good now.
Oh, so you must, maybe you were back in Canada December 44.
That's right, December 44.
Were you still with Temsford?
Yes.
D-Day?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And the night of D-Day, we flew the night just prior in the morning. I remember the Armada. And we dropped all these goofy paratroopers. They looked like real paratroopers with explosives going out from all over the place.
Where did you drop them?
In Normandy.
In Normandy.
Yeah. And that was interesting work. So then I got back to UBC, and I remember on VE Day, my present wife wanted to go out and celebrate and have a good party. And here I was studying for exams, and I wouldn't go out. Seemed a little funny, and Congress didn't. But I didn't. I studied for the exams, and I passed.
And she still married you anyway?
She married me anyhow. That's right. That's right. Yeah, I remember the night I met her at the service center. She asked me my name, and I said, well, you better hang on. It's long and it's foreign. And she said, well, what is it? I said, it's Tommaso, Alberto, Publius, Scipio, Cornelius, Africanus, Caccioni. And she said, is that your real name? And I said, sure. But Tommaso's right. And the Caccioni's right. The rest is a little bit of BS. But that's basically it. It was quite an experience. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I survived. Most of my friends didn't survive.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit about that. What was the size of... Look, the tape is about to run out on this side.
Okay.
Can we just...